So I'm happy to notice the audience calms down a little bit. I'm happy to be here and to speak about astrophysical sources of high energy neutrinos, at least what we think such sources could be. Up to now, such sources have not been seen at high energies, at least. Well, neutrino astrophysics has had its merits already, has earned its merits already. The top questions in astrophysics in the pre-cosmology era were basically how do stars work and how do stars evolve. And two fundamental pieces of the answer came actually from neutrino astrophysics. That was the neutrino deficit that was necessitated by the fact that helioseismology showed that the central temperature of the sun is in fact 15.7 times 10 to the 6 Kelvin, as predicted by the astrophysical models involving these thermonuclear reactions in the center of the sun. And as you all know, this has been awarded a Nobel Prize. Then, how do stars evolve? Burned down to the question in terms of the evolution of the core of the stars, what the final state of this evolution is, and it's neutron stars and black holes for very massive stars, and they should release upon formation a huge burst of neutrinos, and they have been seen, and so Kushiba was awarded too. There are more questions left, of course, and those are related to the cosmology era that we are in right now. I just listed down a few of them. You know, there are the famous 11 top questions in astrophysics by Mike Turner. Now, these are a little bit different. I invented them just for this conference, and I think they deserve some sort of priority for neutrino astrophysics. The first is how do the first stars form, because they must be extremely different from the ones we have today, being metal poor, made out of primordial plasma mainly, and involving therefore much higher masses. A few very recent and noteworthy papers I have listed here in this context. The other question is, of course, what is dark matter? And any massive weakly interacting relic particle would in fact give chances for neutrino astrophysics to find a signal. Then the question is also, what is dark energy? And here, a very remarkable coincidence has shown up. That is, that the energy scale of the vacuum energy is the same as the energy scale of the mass splitting of the neutrinos. Nobody knows at present what this might mean, or if it's just an accident. Then also, as recently pointed out by Chris Quigg, it is very important, in fact, to study neutrino mixing over huge baselines to find rare decays or interactions, possibly with dark energy. The final question on this list is, where do cosmic rays come from? Actually, a very almost ancient question, almost 100 years old. And it's so important in this context because all these searches for signatures, for instance, of dark matter or the first stars, which would be hidden in other messengers, rely on determining the foregrounds, respectively backgrounds. So you must know what the high-energy universe looks like in terms of high-energy neutrinos produced by accelerated particles. And we know already we have a zoo of astrophysical objects producing high-energy particles, such as pulsar wind nebula, driven by pulsars, rotating magnetospheres. We have AGN jets, which are entirely non-thermal in nature. And then there are the gamma-ray bursts, jets very similar, in fact. And this list could be extended by microquasars, supernova remnant shells, etc. But in terms of total energy output, of course, the AGN jets seem to be the most prominent ones, followed by gamma-ray burst jets, although we don't know exactly what the gamma ray burst total contribution to the energy in the universe is if there is a huge number of very faint baryon poisons and therefore slower gamma ray burst jets, they might contribute more than we have actually seen in the BATSI catalog to the gamma ray background and to the cosmic ray background. The question for the experiments is, of course, do we have any guaranteed sources? In astronomy, we would call them standard candles, which we need to calibrate the detector, which we need to optimize the detection technique. And I would say, since we know that cosmic rays exist and radio synchrotron emission exists, we can see it all over the sky. These are total sky maps with photon energies above 100 MeV in the upper panel, and at 480 megahertz, that's GeV energies for the electrons in the lower panel. And you can see the broad galactic disk, which is much thicker than the gas disk, the same in gamma rays as in radio. And you can see some radiation even at high galactic latitudes, which is diffuse in nature. In addition, there are, of course, a lot of point sources at gamma ray energies. Also, of course, in the radio band, they are not shown here. They are subtracted to show only the diffuse component. These are actually cosmic rays diffusing through the interstellar medium and hitting once in a while the material of the interstellar medium, producing pions, and thereby giving rise to gamma ray radiation. We don't have such a sky map at higher energies, which is what we actually need to get high energy neutrino predictions from that. So it's model dependent to scale the gamma ray observations. And even more so, it's model dependent to scale from electron observations, because we need to know something about the electron-proton ratio, which we don't know from first principles. And also we need to know the magnetic field distribution, which we don't know in general. Okay, so inferring neutrino fluxes is a very model-dependent business. Electron observations, which are easily accessible because of the synchrotron emission seen by radio telescopes, which are comparatively cheap, boil down to not knowing the magnetic fields and therefore having a large ambiguity in predicting cosmic ray spectra. Then gamma ray observations, in addition to the fact that we don't have North Sky survey at above TeV energies at very high sensitivity. The best we have is the Milagro data, is hampered by this other difficulty that gamma rays suffer electromagnetic cascading. If they have high enough energy, they will pair produce on the microwave, infrared, or optical and UV backgrounds in the universe, and thereby their spectrum will change. You cannot just convert one-to-one from gamma ray observations to neutrino observations. So again, models enter when you try to predict neutrinos from these observations. The same is actually true for protons, that's cosmic ray protons that you measure. You cannot predict neutrino spectra directly from them, because the protons diffuse and advect with the flow of the scattering centers in the media through which they propagate. As a result, they arrive isotropically at the Earth, and the neutrinos are, of course, propagating more or less in straight lines. Actually, not exactly. They have a small magnetic moment associated with their mass, and they will be deflected by magnetic field gradients a little bit. That's on the arc minute scale for extragalactic sources. So I don't think you can do it very model independently. However, if you just look at the question, what's the isotropic flux, the total flux in the universe of high energy neutrinos produced by cosmic rays, then maybe you can come to an answer by comparing or by inferring such fluxes from the cosmic ray flux. But you need to know, in this case, the extragalactic component of the cosmic rays, which is very difficult, because that determines the calorimetric signal of cosmic rays in all places in the universe. And that's difficult, of course, because we have a strong galactic component sitting on top of the putative extragalactic one. So again, models enter. Let's look at the galactic sources first. I think it's beyond doubt that a galactic source for the bulk of cosmic rays exists. We see that the chemical composition is more or less similar to the solar one, albeit there are some important differences. Volatile elements are somewhat enriched. That's probably because the environment where they are first accelerated is a dusty one, and if dust gets sputtered, then the elements that are bound to dust in the first place are enriched, and we see this effect. Also, we see that the inverse Compton emission from intergalactic space is more or less absent. That would be implied if cosmic rays were found in the universe with the same energy density as they are in situ. Also, we see the diffuse galactic gamma ray emission, and it's consistent at high energies with pi zero. Mixed in, of course, there's also an inverse Compton contribution from the relativistic electrons, accelerated presumably in the same sources. Then also, okay, there are more things like a small isotropy, which must be expected because of energy-dependent leakage. All that mounts evidence to this picture that galactic sources exist and produce the bulk of cosmic rays. However, still we do not know what they are. Gamma ray, ground-based gamma ray observations, which are sensitive at TV energies, have not produced firm evidence of the standard picture due to Ginzburg, because shell-type supernova remnants turn out to be much fainter than they were believed to be. But maybe they are more numerous, or somehow we look at the ones with the wrong ages. In addition to that, there are a lot of sources that can safely be expected. In fact, we know the sun produces high energy neutrinos because it's irradiated from the other side by cosmic rays. And so we receive a flux of high energy neutrinos from the sun. And it can be predicted accurately. Taking into account neutrino oscillations, we deliver something like a few tau leptons in a cubic kilometer detector from the sun, which is interesting, looking at the tau lepton rate in opera, for instance, due to the CNGS. These would be for free, if you can just discriminate them in your detector as being due to tau charge currents. All stars will, in the same way, produce high-energy neutrinos. In particular, their stellar winds will suffer shocks. And if they encounter regions of high density, like in OB associations, where huge amounts of molecular gas is present, then the target density is higher, then more neutrinos will be produced. So it's quite likely, in fact, that these associations will also deliver a measurable amount of neutrinos. The interstellar medium, as I just explained, will also produce neutrinos in the same way pi naughts are produced. Galactic center, supernova remnants, microquasars, pulsar wind nebula, and the list could be extended. But for all these sources, that's the basic point here, there exists a vast literature. You can look up the predictions, but they are model-dependent. As I said, there is no model-independent way to actually do it. If you plot some of these models, in fact, not all, this is taken from a review by John Learned and myself a couple of years ago, then the picture looks like this. You have this huge atmospheric background, which makes life so difficult in high-energy neutrino astrophysics from the ground. Then you have the galactic disk. Depending whether you look towards the center or anti-center, the fluxes are different. And then you have curves here for a variety of sources. Sticking to the galactic ones, I want to draw your attention to the red and blue curves here, numbered 7 and 9 and 8. Now, the curves 7 and 8 were somewhat optimistic estimates for shell-type supernova remnants because we were for a long time supposed to be the canonical sources to produce the bulk of the cosmic rays. And in this picture, they would produce, I think these were calculations by Tom Geiser, neutrino fluxes of this kind. So at 100 GeV, which is where the best sensitivity is reached for Amanda 2. The fluxes are close to 10 to the minus 9 in these units, GV per square centimeter per second, if you refer to 1 degree square bins. Now, the blue curve, however, shows what you must expect from Cassiopeia A, which is one source which has a weak detection in high energy gamma rays, which is sort of then a more realistic condition or constraint to compute the neutrino models. And this, as you can see, drops down by a large factor, 5 or so, from the more optimistic calculations done earlier. So eventually at 100 PV, you come down in 1 degree square bins to something like, this is the intersection point here, something like 10 to the minus 10 in these units, which is extremely difficult to detect, even for IceCube. Okay, this is just to remind you on what was seen here by the Hegra imaging air Cherenkov array, Cassiopeia R, a shell-type supernova remnant, a prototype for cosmic ray acceleration, is very weak at multi-TeV energies, and so the corresponding neutrino flux is very weak too. Maybe shell-type supernova remnant sources are not producing the bulk of the cosmic rays. Maybe pulsar wind nebula or microquasars are more effective. There are some papers around claiming that, and this, of course, would lead us back to the more optimistic estimates for the flux, so which was, okay, let me show it again, which was about 10 to the minus 9 here at 100 TeV energies, which could be detected with IceCube. So it depends a little bit on the number of sources and the individual strengths. If the number of sources is large, the strength is low, you can still do stacked source analysis and thereby enhance your sensitivity. Now let's come to the extragalactic sources. You know that the cosmic ray spectrum remains, that the cosmic ray distribution remains isotropic at high energies, more or less. And this calls for extragalactic sources, or at least sources in a very extended halo. There's a debate going on about the absence or presence of the GCK cutoff. If this GCK cutoff is indeed seen, then this would be a strong argument for a more or less homogeneous or evolving contribution from extragalactic sources of ultra-energy cosmic rays. We expect that actually, if you look at the Hillers plot showing magnetic field versus radius, we know extragalactic sources that are available, like radio galaxies or gamma ray bursts. And the light chemical composition implied by this might also already be seen. The most interesting sources are, in fact, not only because of the Hillers plot, but also in terms of energetics, AGN jets, and gamma ray bursts. And now the models one can do are limited by experimental data in two respects. That's the cosmic ray spectrum shown here, at least the protonic contribution to that, and it's the extragalactic gamma ray background. But the extragalactic background is not directly connected, as I said, to the production of the neutrinos, because the photons that are produced along with the neutrinos in the sources would degrade due to electromagnetic cascades in the source or during propagation. So the spectra will eventually be different. You can only integrate the spectrum of the extragalactic gamma ray background, assuming it's hadronic in origin, and give this into the models as a constraint. Now, the integrated energy flux is something like 10 to the minus 6 in the units GeV per square cm per second per C radian. I come back to this. For the cosmic ray spectrum in protons, data are sparse. If you assume at highest energies that there must be protons, and it's also consistent with this fly's eye data interpretation, and also consistent with Karlsruhe interpretation of spectra around the knee, then you find that a spectrum of around e to the minus, here it is, minus 2.7 is the spectrum for the cosmic ray protons, which would then enter the models as the upper limit, which they shall not overproduce. If you invert the observed cosmic ray spectrum under the constraint that the extragalactic gamma ray background may not be overproduced, you obtain a limit which goes like this curve here, demarking the shaded area to the lower part of the diagram. And this compares to the Waksman and Barkal bound, which is just a straight line, which refers to generic e to the minus 2 spectra emitted by ultra-energy cosmic ray sources. You don't have to really believe that all the sources produce e to the minus 2, or you may not stick to the assumption that they all produce protons up to 10 to the 20th electron volts. They may produce to the 10 to the 15th, 16th, 17th, and so forth energies, and so they may contribute at various energies with different energy fluxes, and therefore the actual limitation is this curve here, and I think we have reached good consensus about this. I recently published this with Eli Waksman in Europhysics Letters in a special volume, that we can rather safely assume that this is in fact the upper limit on the neutrino flux. This is actually just muon neutrino flux, not assuming oscillations from astrophysical sources. The basic assumption which goes in here is in fact that these sources are neutron bombs, because they are all relying on a statistical mechanism to produce the accelerated particles which radiate neutrinos and gamma rays. The particles are trapped. They can only escape upon paying energy to the expansion of the sources, to the expansion of the jets. So they will lose some of the energy they have gained upon escaping. However, after isospin flip, the neutrons that are produced would escape freely and decay far away from their places of origin. And in that case, you can maintain their high energies. And also you have the highest efficiency in producing neutrinos, because for each neutron you produce, you also have a neutrino. In fact, more than one. So this is the optimum neutrino efficiency also, and therefore it gives you upper limits. And it's the gamma ray bursts which have this generic spectrum shown down here and published by Waksman and Bakal, and it's the HN jets which have a spectrum like this, which is published by myself many years ago. And this is more or less confirmed to be realistic predictions under the cosmic ray constraint. Actually, it was constructed in this way originally. You can produce models which have somewhat higher neutrino production. Remember what I said. This limit must rise towards the limitation by the extragalactic gamma ray background in the 100 TeV domain, where actually the main sensitivity of Amanda and IceCube and Antares is or will be. And so you can ask, what's the maximum neutrino flux you can expect from the most optimistic models? And so we constructed an AGN model together with Jörg Grahan and Ray Prothero, who I did this. And these models would look like this solid curve, for instance, having about an order of magnitude more than the Waksman-Barkhardt limit in this energy domain here, around 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 9 GeV. But still, since most of these would come from photoproduction of pions, there would be a deficit of low energy neutrinos, comparatively low energy, so that's below 100 TeV. When you confront this with current experimental upper limits, they are not so. Let's see, this is Amanda B10. Of course, there are now Amanda 2 limits already, so this is an old plot. Then you can see that by marching down with this limit via Amanda 2 and then IceCube, you can easily check all the energy levels that are predicted as upper limits from these models. And so if you believe that cosmic rays of extragalactic origin exist, then you will very surely test this with IceCube. There is one remark of concern, finally now, because as I said, the two constraints are most important, the cosmic ray proton flux and the extragalactic gamma ray bound. But the extragalactic gamma ray background has been newly determined very recently by Andy Strong, Igor Moskalenko, and Olaf Reimer. And what they did was they subtracted an GEV component, which is due to inverse Compton emission in the galactic halo. It must be there because we know in the galactic halo, remember my third slide showing this, is rich in relativistic electrons, cosmic ray electrons diffusing out. And so they produce inverse Compton gamma ray emission in the GEV region. If you subtract that as a foreground, which hasn't been done in the previous analysis by Sri Kumar, for instance, then the extragalactic background, in fact, gets a new structure. It will show this dip here around GEV energies. And it's safe under all systematic errors. This has been discussed extensively in their paper. So it looks like it's the two-component nature. It's the e to the minus 2.3 spectrum below GEV, and it is an excess above GEV, which can be modeled actually rather nicely with neutralino dark matter annihilation of neutralinos with 520 GeV and a rather high cross-section. It can also be modeled by AGN emitting very hard spectra. However, the chi-square is worse compared with the dark matter scenario, and also you predict a huge number of sources above 300 GeV or 100 GeV, where now a huge number of imaging air Cherenkov telescopes are operative and look through source catalogs and don't find them in this numerousness. Because if you want to produce a gamma ray background at a few hundred GeV, corresponding to this dotted curve here, you would need like 1,000 sources of the kind that have been seen previously. You don't see barely as many. So maybe it's in fact true that the extragalactic sources making up the diffuse background, the faint sources, have in fact an energy spectrum on average which is more like power law with minus 2.3 rather than 2.0 or 2.1 as thought previously. And that implies, which is a profound implication, that it cannot be due to cascading of some input at higher energies. Cascading would always produce something very close to e to the minus 2.0, but this is 2.3. So that means one would have to scale down. Just a side remark, this scenario would also involve a cosmogenic background due to neutralino annihilation, which has this spectrum, which shows up above the summed emission from all galaxies at 100 GeV energies, but you would only be able to see it if you have a new tau detector, of course, because the atmospheric background sits on top of this. Let me summarize very briefly. We do have guaranteed sources. The galactic disk, the sun, the GCK, if you believe in it, so, right? Then secondly, the steady sources that produce the knee, up to knee cosmic ray sources, and also, in fact, the AGN have similar flux levels. You have individual sources with fluxes of the order of 10 to the minus 9 to 10 to the minus 10 in these units. Actually, I prefer the lower value. There will be an omnidirectional intensity produced by all the extragalactic sources, including the GCK neutrinos, which is of the order of 5 times 10 to the minus 8 to 5 times 10 to the minus 7, depending a little bit on energy. You remember this curved shape of the upper limit. Now, given the fact that the extragalactic gamma ray background has this spectral feature, the implication would be that the lower values of the order of the Waxman-Barkhal bound would be the preferred ones. And fourth, okay, this is a detail about the gamma ray burst contribution. We don't know maybe enough about them since the Batze sensitivity allowed us only to see the brightest ones. And we don't know much about their high energy emissions. So I'm expecting very much that the imaging air Cherenkov telescopes and GLAST will let us learn more about the high energy emissions from gamma ray burst to improve the theoretical modeling and to improve the neutrino predictions, in fact. That's one reason why we made our magic telescope on La Palma. Yeah, thank you. I'll finish. to make our magic telescope at La Palma a telescope which can point to any source on the sky within 20 seconds. So we can follow up alerts of gamma ray bursts to find if they emit at above 50 GeV energies, or maybe above 10 GeV, because they would saturate our detector in terms of rate. Final remark is there might also be, but this is not a guaranteed source, neutralino-induced cosmogenic tau neutrinos at around 100 GeV. So thank you for your attention. Thank you for inviting me here.
Thank you. I have time for a couple of questions.
Normally, diffuse gamma ray background is supposed to be from huge number of unresolved sources. How could you explain, please, why you say that it's not good fit if you, and you have just 1,000 sources contributing to this region? Thank you.
So the question was why I need. Okay, if this is a spectrum which is indeed, which is due to AGN, you need one component with deep spectra to make this sub-GV part, and another one with very flat spectra, which makes the harder part. And if you assume that they have a generic spectrum reaching up to the TV region, because we have an unbiased sample of nearby sources, which are not cosmologically attenuated, which indeed show up, like Macquarie 421, 51, etc., then there are some emission over the whole flux distribution of them would look like this. It is only turning over here because of cosmological pair attenuation. But this pair attenuation, even for an evolving contribution from the luminosity function of these sources, would not lead to a sharp turnover. It's a shallow turnover, so that the flux level in the diffuse background at a few hundred GeV is always as high as like 5 times 10 to the minus 7 or so. And now if you compare that with the flux of a source seen by Whipple, then you find you need 1,000 of such sources. That's the basic point. And if you have now experiments running which have a higher sensitivity, they must all show up. Hess is operating now for, I don't know, almost 2 years. They haven't seen so many sources yet.
Thank you. Okay, I think that we have to go on. Let's thank the speaker again.